Welcome to the Mike Quirk Podcast.
Now give me my theme music.
PST Sport is a design and build specialist contractor focusing exclusively on the design and construction of world-class artificial grass pitches for football, GAA, rugby, hockey and tennis. They offer a complete construction solution for any pitch development project, both greenfield sites and returfing older pitches, covering design, pitch construction and project management. Their extensive portfolio includes over 500 artificial grass pitches with numerous full-size pitches across Ireland and the UK. They have constructed multiple fields, tested and approved to FIFA, World Rugby, GAA and FIH standards, as well as many training size surfaces. PST Sport know and understand that many pitch projects require a significant amount of work to be completed prior to the project becoming a reality. Their approach to every project begins with understanding their clients' needs, and they can work with you to deliver a fully designed and considered solution prior to the construction stage. Whether you require a resurfacing of your existing pitch, or if you want a full turnkey installation, PST Sport will provide you with a full service tailored solution. For more information, please check out their website at pstsport.com. Again, I'm looking to roll out about 10 episodes over the next couple of months, kindly supported again by PST, and to chat to lots of different coaches and people in leadership positions in sport and in business to try and, you know, provide a little bit of insight to all of us to find what works for them and what's successful in their field, and hopefully all of us can learn a little bit from it. As always, I've linked this to a charity. Previously, I would have been involved with Temple Street Children's Hospital, most recently with the Recovery Haven Cancer Support Group in Kerry. And this time, I'm delighted to say that I've linked up with the Lily Daly Foundation, a brand new charity based in Kerry, who are doing fantastic work to raise money for the Heart Ward in Crumlin Children's Hospital and also to the Ronald McDonald House, two charities that were very important to them during their time. So there'll be a link in the podcast description below. Again, maybe I had the opportunity to put this behind a paywall and maybe that people would be charged a subscription monthly to do it. I didn't think that would be the right thing to do because I like to link a charity to it. So instead of doing that, if you can afford a couple of euros, it would be great to jump onto that I Donate page and throw a couple of euros in there. And if not, if you can't afford that, that's absolutely fine. But I'd ask you to share it around. If you're involved in any sports club, stick it into your WhatsApp group, your coaches group, share it around on social media. The more people that listen, inevitably, the more people that will donate. So again, check out the Lily Daly Foundation. Look them up. Look up their website. Support them in any way you can. Spread the word of what they're doing. I spoke to Lily's mom, Caroline. It's there in the first episode that we looked at. If you want a really full picture of exactly what that foundation is all about, and once you listen to that, you know, you'll understand that they're very much worth supporting. So, without further ado, I'm delighted to get on to our first guest this week. So delighted to welcome Mick Bohan, Dublin Ladies Football Manager. All-Ireland winner, obviously, this year. We have a really, really good chat about the difference between the ladies' game and the men's game, the perception and the narrative that's out there about people coaching ladies' football as opposed to men's football, how he sees that, how he sees the game, how he sees coaching, how he sees developing skills. So if you're involved in GAA, soccer, rugby, basketball, there's something for you in this. Hope you enjoy. I was just reading over stuff earlier, Mick, and I was going through, you know, your title was the skills coach with Jim Gavin back around 2010 and 12 with the under 21 championships. Then the same in kind of 2013 with the senior All-Ireland men's, a couple of Sigerson's, three Sigerson's with DCU. You were with Cullum Collins and Clare in 2013. And then obviously you've transitioned over to the ladies game in the last number of years. Maybe just talk about, because it's an interesting transition in terms of switching from the men's game to the ladies game. What maybe inspired that change or what brought about, you know, that move?
So I'll reverse the digger, Mike.
I was 33 years as a PE teacher,
Right.
and I worked in a community school with boys and girls. And just to put this in perspective as regards sport, because obviously, a lot of obviously Gaelic football is going to be, dominate the talk. But I started the first girls soccer team in St. Mark's Community School.
Right.
I spent as much time coaching basketball or soccer as I did Gaelic games. It was a matter of whatever was in front of you and whatever the kids wanted to play. And I spent as much time with boys' teams as I did with girls' teams, and I always tried to take a team of each every year in the school, because you know yourself, you're going into the school and the kids are going, "Oh, you're only interested in working with the boys, you're
Yeah.
only interested in working with the girls." So now it, and I can honestly say to you, it didn't bat an eyelid to me whether I was with a boys' team or a girls' team. And yeah, there was frustrations with one, that was made up by assets that the other gave to you, or vice versa. So I could, I'd know the things that the enjoyments I got out of working with different codes. Girls were incredibly receptive, boys a little bit more driven sometimes. Then you find a group who are dynamic and sure they do anything you asked, regardless of what sex they were. And so I spent my life like that. Like, I mean, in my own, I've three girls and a boy myself. And I can tell you, going back to 2002, I was involved with the Dublin Development Squads. The Dublin Development Squads, there's the boys now, started in 2001, the first development squad that we had. 2002 was the second one, and Brian Cullen was on it. Like, under 14, went brought him up through minor, and luckily enough, worked with him in Sigerson, and then luckily enough, worked with him with the senior footballers. So all those, stories, which are, not people, many people know, but you hold close to yourself. Like, so I remember back in 2002, a pal of mine took over a Dublin ladies team, and I ended up coaching them. And I was told at the time, and I'll never forget it, "What are you wasting your time by? This was somebody a high profile involved in lads football. What are you wasting your time with the girls for?" And I remember been taken aback by that, because that's not how I live my Monday to Friday. That's my job, was going in with boys and girls, and I genuinely didn't see it as a higher status to work with the boys' team in the school ahead of the girls' team. I just didn't, right? And I know that might sound mad, and like, one of the things that I would actually take a bit of pleasure out of is that, I was lucky enough to be involved with Jimbo and with the 21s in 10 and 11, and then the seniors in 13 and 14. And so long before, like, a lot of people, the way people, and even in club, they choose, there's a good failure team coming in, and they want to get the failure team, because if they get the failure team and they're successful, they might get the senior team. Like, I can honestly tell you this, and I took massive, personal satisfaction out of involved with the lads, but it wasn't any greater than the girls. And I can honestly put my hand on my heart and say that, in spite of the fact that I was, we were in a cauldron with what, 82,500 people, and as opposed to a cauldron of whatever, 36,000 or 50,000 or whatever is going to be, it didn't matter. It just didn't matter. It was a game. And you were going out to contest the game, and you were starting with a group at a certain level, and you were trying to bring them somewhere else. So even when I go around the country, with a girls' team or a boys' team, at times the standards would be horrific, how people would treat one compared to the other. And I'd be shaking my head thinking, for real? And having been involved in both, as a result of that expectation, a standard comes. But I would have had the same standard with the kids in school. Like, I mean, if they didn't arrive in with their school colours, I'm not saying I wouldn't let them play, but I'd make an issue of it. I'd talk to them about, "Well, I wouldn't expect you to line out for your club in the incorrect colours, or I wouldn't expect you to come with your boots, not prepared for a game, muddy boots. You haven't even taken them out of the bag since the weekend. Like, where's your self-esteem?" So all those things, and you understand it as someone who played the game. You'd naturally pass on those messages to your kids, but there's an awful lot of people. Like I met a friend of mine this evening who worked with me this year, Shane Kenny, and I was just talking to him about the commitment for intercounty football. That there are so few people understand what you do, even people who are close to you. You know, they know you're gone, they know you're putting hours in, but they don't realise if you go to McDonald's or Bewley's, or it's on your mind, your phone is hopping, you're in a conversation or having a meal out with your family, but your head isn't at the meal, it's at something else. There's somebody down with the SSC, they're getting an MRI, you're waiting on the results, you need to get to see a specialist in 48 hours, you're waiting for the phone call to come back to someone to do you a favour. Everything, all those things. So, yeah, that wasn't the question you asked me, Mike.
But no, but listen, I can tell already you're a great guest to have, because you have 6 minute answers, which is ideal. But it's an incessant it's an incessant kind of you know, just you're just locked into it, and again, the point you make, and I've two boys, I've twin boys, and I've a girl. And you have to put in the time, the same with herself as you do with the two boys. And why would you expect anything different, you know? But that perception or that narrative that you highlighted there as why would you waste your time, or, you know, it's a step backwards or it's a step sideways, is certainly one that's prevalent within the GAA.
It's incredible. I mean, and I've said this over the last couple of years, and I'm so lucky in my career to have worked with so many good people. So I say it with an understanding, but I also say it with an authority, because, like, I'm not trying to, you get to a stage in your life. I remember saying this to my mom about 10 years ago. It's actually a nice stage in your life where you don't care anymore what people think. You just go out and be what you are. And you're not trying to prove anything to anyone. You just, like, I mean, people don't like you. And I say that a little bit tongue-in-cheek. We always care a little bit what people think about us. But when you stop trying to impress someone, when you stop trying to, you just do the things you believe in. That's a nice stage to get to in life. So, like that, when I'm talking with the girls or the boys, and I look at, you know, the people who've come in with me over the last couple of years. Frankie Robach. Frankie was Jim Gavin's right-hand man. Shane Carney would have worked with us with stats. Sammy Dowling came in as an S&C coach, worked with Pat Gilroy in 11 and 12. Paul Casey would have played senior football under Giller and, you know, was a marvellous servant for Dublin for over a decade. Derek Murray would have played with the Dubs and over a long period of time and a massively respected club footballer. You know, of Claire Butterley, sort of, all these people who just committed their time to come. And it's a lovely feeling to know that you're surrounded by just good quality people involved in the game, giving back stuff. And as a result of that, the journey is made really special. That's the part. And, like, I mean, you know, I look this year, obviously we ended up and it turned well for us, but I can tell you, honestly, this was a dark year for us for lots of months. And I know people don't, you know what I mean? When you say that to somebody who's, you probably never experienced getting to this level, because, I mean, you know, I spent a year with Claire, as you know, with Colm Collins, and, you know, and some good stories to tell from that, because, you know, I had come from our senior lads into Clare senior football, which was a serious change, and, you know, some good and some bad. But the bottom line is that, you know, when you end up winning something or you're successful at the top level, you actually do get to look at the picture a little bit clearer. You do, like, I mean, I can genuinely say to you, and I know, if, you know, the year I spent with Clare, if you talk to people from Clare who've never experienced, obviously, winning a senior All-Ireland in either whatever, girls or boys, if you say this to them, they say, think it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek. So you need to have experienced it in order to say it. But I can tell you, I took learnings from that year that I wouldn't have learned anywhere else that have benefited me hugely as a coach. I took incredible pleasure out of certain things, more so than possibly working with our lads team or our girls team, because the bounce was so much higher from certain things. So, but you have to have experienced this and this in order to compare it or to tell the story. Yeah. Does that make sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, no, and that's a like that Dublin success, and we're probably jumping around the place, but that's no harm. But that Dublin to Clare is a very interesting one, and you're talking about, you know, some of the things that you learn there. Like, that's a very interesting perspective for people even now. Like, that was how long ago? What year was that?
So that was 2016.
16, yeah. So we're like 16 to here now is like, you know, the way football has moved and evolved, it's like two decades. But like, what were if I was to put you on the spot and say, give me a couple of those things that really stood out for you in terms of you left there being a better coach because you picked up these couple of things due to that change of environment?
Well, the first thing I can tell you is the first training session we had was in November during the band time in Cratlow.
Right.
And a great character who was kit man at the time said to me, will you be using the footballs tonight? And I looked at him with a smile on my face and I said, I will. He says, well, how many do you need? And I said, well, how many's training? And he said to me, 16. And the first thing I remember thinking, 16? Well, that's interesting. That would have been half of the pitch from what I would involved in the previous year. So that was fine. So then I said, we'll need 16 footballs. And he chuckled to himself and he walked away. And I said, what are you laughing at? He said, Mick, we wouldn't be used to taking the balls out here until in around June. And I remember laughing to myself. And then the second thing, we were introducing the whole concept of the complex skills, which was the two footballs and right foot, left foot, right hand, left hand. And, you know, and Gary Brennan, who was fantastic, turned to me and said, Mick, genuinely, we struggled to control one football, never mind two. Now, there was a bit of banter in it, but you can imagine the lads, you know, the first night training with two footballs each and looking at this gobshite of a dub walking in thinking, who the fuck does he think he is? But it was a matter of, I still remember thinking, one of the great things was I just launched myself into that. This is it, guys. If you want it, this is what I'm going to give you. I can develop. I can help you improve as footballers. If you want to have a go at this, let's just buy into it. And there was guys questioning me and there was fellas, you know, throwing in their tuppence halfpenny worth and whatever else. But little by little, and I tell a great story about Gordon Kelly, who I would have had huge time for, and a marvellous servant for Clare. And he was centre-back, and I can't remember what age Gordon was at the time, but he was into his 30s. And I remember driving down the road one night, realising we were coming out of defence really slow, and I turned to Gordon and I said, Gordon, it's only after dawn on me here. I said, I know I'm slow. I'm here about 10 or 11 weeks, but the reason we're coming out of defence so slow is you're not kicking the ball. And he said to me, Mick, 10 years ago, I was told not to kick it and I haven't kicked the thing since. And I remember thinking, oh my God,
yeah,
is that what we're at? That summer, Gordon Kelly scored a point with his left foot against Sligo. And I can tell you, there was as much celebration in the changing room afterwards over his left-footed point as there was about the victory. And that was the bit they started to get, that this wasn't all results-driven. It was incremental towards skill. And, you know, if you do A, B, and C, well, the likelihood is you'll get a response to it at the far end. So, but the other thing was the cultural bit. I mean, Colm, you know, and I would have said this to people afterwards, would Colm survive with Kerry or Dublin? I don't know. But here's what he had. He knew every bit about those young fellas' backgrounds. He knew about their families. He knew who was working, who wasn't working. He knew aunties and uncles. And so he had an insight into them far beyond any insight I ever had with any player I dealt with. And I remember thinking, Now that's interesting, because if you know about them and you care a little bit more about them, you're going to, and he had to do that because he was dealing with such small numbers. And I just thought it was intriguing to see, like, it was like, it was the father. He was watching out for them. Even a lad would be late, and I'd be going, Colin, that fella's after walking in late last 3 nights. And he'd go, yeah, yeah, but he's coming from, and I'd go, yeah, but I'm after driving from London. But he knew there was something behind the behind.
Yeah,
we had that bit of compassion or whatever, which I necessarily didn't come with. But the bottom line is that's things you have to have those. And so I would that was a big learner for me. And we would have, you know, gone toe to toe on it at times, because sometimes compassion and standards, you know, have to meet somewhere in the middle ground.
Yeah. Funny, I was chatting to Rob Mulcahy, who's doing fierce work in Clare GAA at the moment, and he would have worked with Cullum on the S&C side. I'm not sure if he was there in your time, probably not. But he used the term just that Cullum really cared. He said, yeah, really, really cared. That same point about would he have survived maybe in a Dublin or Kerry? Who knows? But he really cared about all those fellas. And in turn, they kind of had those same feelings towards him and would give that little bit extra, which... You know what? It's a lot of the stuff is X's and O's, but it's still a people game. Zach Johnson, I'm not sure if you're a golf guy. Zach Johnson was interviewed at the end of the Ryder Cup this afternoon, and it was a hard interview. Now the lady was asking him some pretty penetrating questions for a guy who was just after suffering a very raw defeat. She was asking about the process, and he was just talking about the process. For me, is all about the people. It is the players, it's their wives, their girlfriends, the caddies, their partners. And that was the big thing, that even in defeat, he was still talking about the people. And I think that's becoming a little bit more prevalent in coaching and management as well. Now, how, you know, those people that really look out for people are also, there's a role for them as well, I suppose, you know?
And I would say that to you that, like, I mean, you know, the certain skill sets, you can't have every skill set. It's not possible. And so I would definitely have earmarked that on my management teams, like having watched Colum in action, saying that's not a forte of mine. I mean, I often say this to people when I'm giving coaching courses that, you know, over the years, the thing I've learned to do a bit better is shut my mouth, you know, when somebody hasn't done as well as I would have expected. But I certainly don't have the capacity to go over and tell them they've done well when they haven't. So other people are good at putting that arm around their shoulder. I am not. I'm better off away from them until, you know, the next training session or whatever else. And that's the, you know, I've learned to do that a little bit better. But if you can't, you know, if you can't have some, if you're not capable of saying positive things, then you need to get people around you who are. Because ultimately, that's all part of it. Like, I mean, obviously, you know, as well, our youth have changed in that regard, and they do want more affirmative comments than otherwise. I mean, I would have grown up, you know, in an era where it was fine being lashed out of it. And now you do that to somebody and they take massive umbrage at it. So it's a matter now, well, okay, that's fair enough. So you don't do that. But you equally need someone to come with decent stuff to them when they're down. So if you're not able to do it, well, get somebody who is. And if you don't do that, then there's a void.
Yeah. And you mentioned there maybe the clash between that and maybe developing those kind of cultural standards that you need for your group to be able to flourish and to succeed. What are without, obviously, you know, it's nothing specific to Dublin, but over the time that you have, you know, evolved your coaching and management, what are some of those kind of cultural standards that you like to bring into a team and try and get the most out of them?
Well, the bottom line is a team sets its own culture. You know, it's obviously those tiers are formed from obviously management down. But I would have a massive regard for what the leadership group in each of the teams I've been involved in have set as standards. Now, some of that sometimes needs direction. But I remember Desi Farrell, I would have heard this from Desi years ago. And I remember having this conversation about culture, and he gave me a really good summary or synopsis of culture. And the synopsis of culture was Well, that's how we do things around here. And for me, that sums it all up. That's how we do things around here. What does that mean? Well, somebody walks into DCU for training, whether they're from Armagh or Kerry or Tyrone, are we going to ignore them or are we going to invite them in? Are we going to make them feel welcome? So like that, you know, there's no such thing as the enemy. Like the enemy, that's ridiculous. Like, I mean, yes, when you play somebody and you're there's a prize up for grabs for those 65 or 70 minutes or whatever, yes, of course, there's a certain expectation of everyone. But when you're in a normal surrounds, whether it's, you know, on your way to training or you're away to a game, whatever, it's not a weakness to shake hands with somebody or to look them in the eye or to wish them the best of luck or equally to, you know, I mean, obviously the All Blacks would have set the standards for most people on the whole concept of sweeping the sheds. But it's all that was a piece of their culture. And all of us said that. Like, I mean, you know, the amount of people, groundsmen over the years who would have said to me that certain teams leave the place in a state. And you think to yourself, geez, I don't want to be remembered as one of those teams that did this. So, but equally, I mean, and no more, you know, than I'm sure yourself, Mike, on the sidelines at times, there's things I've done or said, you wouldn't exactly feel you're covering yourself in glory. And you sit yourself back at the end of the day and say, Jesus, I wish I hadn't done that. Or you get the opportunity to pick up the phone to a fella or a girl and say, look, I'm sorry about that. That's not what I meant and got caught up in the moment. But even having the capacity to say that and, you know, even to your players to say, look, I made a mistake. I shouldn't have done that. That was... them seeing you as vulnerable and saying, well, if he can make a mistake, I can make a mistake. And so all those things, that's culture. That's the reality. And, you know, no more than at home and you say something stupid and, you know, you're tired and whatever else, and you get up the following morning and you say, look, I didn't mean that. That's, you know, there was too many things going on.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing. So what is culture? That's exactly what it is, how your team carries itself. And, like, I look back to moments, you know, the 2020 All-Ireland final, we were beaten by Meath. And one of the proudest things I can say to you that I've ever been involved in sport is that every single one of my players walked over and shook hands with the Meath players. And I know people can dismiss that. You know, that when you're at you're most vulnerable, when you're hurting the most, that's not always easy to do. And I look back and I think, and I would even say it to them this year, there is a way to wear the crown. And, you know, when you win or when you lose, there's a way to carry yourself. And all those things are extremely important. And obviously it's lovely to get to experience it, you know, on the good side, but then when it doesn't go for you, that's probably when you're judged the most.
And it's obviously very difficult. It's anybody can be a good winner, but it's taking those things the right way and handling the right way is look, isn't that sport though? That's like sport is a microcosm of life in general, and particularly for young people. I think that is the greatest glory of sport, is that we are preparing people to be good adults and live your life in a way that's, you know what, you can look people in the eye and you can contribute what you can to society and look out for people. That's what sport is. There's very few people are going to, you know, be in that top couple of percent that will be inter-county footballers, male or female, or international soccer players or premiership. That's a small, tiny percentage, but it's the rest of those people. And that's one of the reasons that I like to do this thing, because I still think that coaches... like we can coach at all age groups, and I mean from the very bottom to the very top, in a much better way, particularly keeping kids playing games. Like you spoke about being a PE teacher and you know, treating the girls' basketball team the same as the boys' soccer team. And like across the board, if we can get our coaching to a place where we keep so many kids more than are there right now playing the games for longer, like that can only benefit us, you know, for years and years to come, for them as people and for us as a society, I suppose, which is a very grand view of what we're trying to do. But I think that's a powerful kind of thing. Like, you spoke about the culture even like at that level. But if we're talking about doing that for a guy, you know, somebody here who's coaching under eights or under tens, football or hurling or camogie or soccer or rugby, whatever clubs they might be involved in, how can they start to, you know, get kids thinking in that kind of a way, the way you're talking about in terms of leadership group? Maybe not as easy to do if you're under 10 or 11 or 12, but how can we start to set those standards for people of those age groups?
Most of my career, Mike, no more than yourself, has been involved away from inter-county teams. Like, I mean, 33 years of taking minimum of two teams a year in school, a lifetime involved with my club, my own two little ones. I have a 10 and a 13-year-old starting all over again, their football careers. I have a 22 and a 24-year-old. And, you know, all of those I would have put time in when they were playing. And even now, you know, I'd see a parent on the sideline and they'd say, you know, about a coach, and well, he's really good or she's really good. And you say, well, have you told them that? No. Well, tell them that. Because, like, my grandfather used a term, give me a compliment, it'll keep me going for a month. And I'd say that to them. Like, I mean, coaches need energy. You need to give them energy. They're doing a good job. Tell them they're doing a good job. And small little things, not only you tell them, tell your little fella, your little one at the end of the session, Sean, that was brilliant, or Louise, that was great. Thanks a million for that. That means so much. And that's part of creating a healthy culture. And more than collecting the bibs at the end is a part of creating a healthy culture. Or been late for a training session. Yeah, you're late. You got caught. Mom and dad were under pressure. Whatever. That's no problem. But don't run straight into the training session. Run over to the coach and say, I'm really sorry we got caught. I'm back. Why? Because that's just respect. That's all. Somebody else has given up their time. That's so now you're starting to create culture. And a positive culture. But I do a lot of coaching courses around the country, Mike. Now, time obviously doesn't allow too many, but I do probably four or five a year. But one of the key things that I'd include in it are a common language. And why would you use a common language? Well, like, there's so many people coming from so many different backgrounds into Gaelic games. Like, I mean, if you have a parent who played basketball or soccer or rugby, well, their language is completely different than the people who came through Gaelic games. But equally, using that common language, well, what does that mean, right? So when you come to your training session, the language of, you know, first touch, or the language of next up, or the language of two-touch football, or all those things, your language, your common language, starts to create a culture in itself. So you've a behavioral thing, you've a common language, and all of a sudden your language and your culture start to unify. They come together, and little by little you grow this. So you grow your language and you grow your culture in tandem. And that's, it's like I'd often say, like, you listen to the Sunday game, people talk about plan A, plan B, or plan C. I can honestly tell you in Gaelic games, there's no plan A or plan B. There's concepts. The game is played through concepts. Sometimes the concept is to move the ball quick. Sometimes the concept is to move the ball slow. Sometimes the concept is to go wide. Sometimes it's to go narrow. They are concepts, right? So you build your concepts, you build your common language, and you build your culture. And that can be done with an under 10 team or a senior team. And you start building a common language, you start building the concepts of play, and you start building a positive environment, or a culture, if you want to put that term on it, right, in tandem. And you're going a long way towards being successful.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah. Now, that probably wouldn't sound as sexy on the Sunday game, though, and they need to jazz it up a little bit to make sure it's a little bit more complicated, because they find stuff that, you know, I've never seen in games, but it does look good on the screen when they start drawing lines.
This is a little bit controversial, but that does matter. I was in Paris the weekend, and down a side street, I met Peter Canavan. I think I might have said this to you, and I talked to him. I like listening to Peter Canavan on air. And I said this to him. I said, I enjoy listening. There's not too many are breaking the game down. And I made this point. I said, there's an awful lot of poor commentary on our games. If a fella kicks a ball away or a girl kicks a ball, break it down. What do they do wrong? Do they take a wrong shot? Were they out of their range? Was the technique right or wrong? That's part of what it's like at the moment. I rang Hannah Tyrrell after the Irish game, and I have limited knowledge of rugby, right? And I couldn't understand the game, the numbers of times that we were getting hammered on a drop off. And I was in my own head thinking, they couldn't be onside. They couldn't have made that because we were under so much pressure.
Yeah.
And then I was talking with the line, and she gave me an insight into it that I hadn't even considered, right? And I was there thinking, That's the stuff you want to hear. When you, like, I mean, break the game down as if I don't understand it. And if I do, well then, okay, so be it. We understand that. But there's an awful lot of people who watch the games who really genuinely don't understand it at that level because they haven't coached at that level or played at that level. And that's probably the majority. So I'd love to see the commentary go back a little bit. It's an awful lot of it are lines that are repeated and sound good and whatever. Break the game down.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Controversy over. No, it's not really. It's just, yeah, that's what you're... I'm the same with the rugby. I love the physicality of it and the almost brutality of that Ireland-South Africa game. You're looking at it saying, that's incredible. And but there are technical aspects to that game that I just don't understand because I haven't played the game. So some of the commentary in the rugby, I really enjoy, like listening to Don Lennon or somebody who's actually giving you a little bit of insight about the nuance that's happening in a scrum where I'm just looking at a group of fellas, you know, pushing at each other. And now suddenly you're getting a little bit more of, okay, so this is actually happening. So I'm looking out for this the next time it happens. And look, that's the whole, I think that's the idea of analysis. Analysis should be about enlightening people to what's going on that they're already not aware of. And the next time it happens, no, you need to be looking out for this because that's what I just showed you. But anyway, that's we're getting a little bit off center. I want to say a big thank you to GameSense Coaching for their support of the podcast. They're a GA coaching platform that advocate for a games-based approach that is suitable for teams of all ages. Their app and website allows you to plan, share, and download your sessions. Train your team the way you want them to play by creating a focus for every session using themes and principles of play. With over 25 live sessions and 300 videos of activities and skills, each session can be unique and players are kept engaged and interested. It is an ideal platform for clubs to share ideas, sessions, or build a library of resources for your own club. You can find out more information at www.gamesensecoaching.com or on Twitter at GAASense. That's GAASENSE. You can also use the code GAMESENSE23 to get 20% off all packages right now. In terms of the, I just wanted to go back to the skills there a second, because you kind of initially, you know, when I first heard of you, it was as a skills coach and this idea of two balls and one person and developing the skills. Maybe just talk a little bit about that idea of the development of skills in Gaelic games or in any game really, but what are the things that you really look for there to try and drive and improve skills along the way?
Well, the first thing I'll say to you on that is this, right? The first question, not the first question, but certainly that question I get asked no matter where I go in the country, no matter what coaching day or what club, whether it's development squad coaches, inter-county coaches, club coaches, it's always the same. How do you develop decision-making? That's the number one. How do you develop decision-making? Because decision-making is key. Well, the number one key aspect to making good decisions is having a high skill set. If you don't have a high skill set, you have a small repertoire in which to pick from in the first place. So the higher the skill set, the better the repertoire of decisions that you have to pick from, right? So that's the first thing. Why would you develop your skills? Well, you're going to have a various array of decisions to make. And so, for example, the simplest one of all is you go to put the ball over the bar with your right foot. Somebody comes to block you. You turn back onto your left. Oh, I don't have a left foot. Well, that's that decision fairly much made up anyway. So now what are you going to do? You're going to hand pass off. You're going to try and beat them. Do you go backwards? So the key decision has been taken away from you because you're not able to execute it. So that's the reasoning behind developing your skills. So ultimately, I would have spent forever, like most coaches, do you know what I mean? You know, I would have gone up to the park and I would have watched the soccer team or go across the road. I lived opposite the rugby club in Lontarf, watching training sessions, picking up drills. And you'd see a drill and say, geez, that's brilliant. And you'd pick the drill and you'd bring it back and you'd do it with your team. And I spent years, like, I mean, I'd say I had training sessions. Dublin Airport had nothing on the runways I had with Collins. They looked magnificent. Yeah. But to what avail? Mm. Like, and all of a sudden, it like a sledgehammer hit me. What am I doing these for? What, like, what's the purpose? And for sure, if you're starting off a skill with kids, you know, you're going to have different shapes and whatever else. And but to what avail? What are you trying to do? So even now, like, I hate the word drills. And so we use the term game-relevant patterns of movement. And that's, you know, ultimately, so everything you try and train towards should be relevant towards the game. So if you're doing triangular work or if you're doing angles or runs, it should be with a view to either breaking out a defence or breaking a defence down. But it has to be relevant to the game. You don't have enough time to do all the other stuff, right? If you're taking a training session and you're just doing a little bit of skill work, whatever else, or you have a juvenile team, whatever, that's fine. So you're not working towards a greater good of a pattern of movement. But as they start to get older, so they're getting to 13, 14, 15, so the game now is developing for them. They now know more than catching and kicking or scoring or tackling. They now know that, you know, they can work out a defence in twos or threes. They now know if you kick a ball into a full forward and you have an angled runner off it and someone in the back post, you can get a palm goal. So they now, so if you're going to do that, well, then you need to practice it. So how do you create those scenarios in your training session? So coming back to the skill-based, well, you have two hands and two feet. You need to be able to use them. Well, how do you incorporate, because I mean, we've a limited amount of time in a training session. And, you know, but say you take a juvenile team, in most cases, like I know my kids, you get an hour slot twice a week. By the time you've set up and the team before you get off, you might get your 55 minutes. So you have 55 minutes in order to try and train a team, improve their skills, get them to understand how to play. You need to be a bit organized now, because if you're not organized, you're in trouble. So for me, it's a no-brainer. At the start of every training session, we can do all of our skills with two footballs for 10 minutes. And that means every child is getting to use right and left foot and right and left hand. So we have a series of activities that we would use. You know, a simple little exercise, starting off one player, two footballs, solo right, solo left, bounce right, solo left, bounce left, solo right, hand pass left, partner off the go, does the same. Next, solo right, solo left, bounce right, solo left, bounce left, solo right, kick left. And you progress it and whatever else. So we'd have scoring challenges. We actually, this isn't trying to promote this now this evening, Mike. It's actually going online next week. My first two coaching manuals are going online next week. And we're doing it as a fundraiser for the team. A skill challenge and scorecard booklet. It's a personal skills challenge for a player. So each player has their own, and they record them, because if you don't record them, sure, how do you develop, right? So we have that, and we have a coaching booklet with modified games in it that we find particularly useful. But I had promised a long-time friend of mine, Lord rest him, John Morrison, passed away, and I had always promised him I'd put my work at some stage into print. And then I remember just this year thinking, okay, we had did it some for the development squads, and then we were using them with our own group. And then at the end of the year, I just said, you know what, I'm actually going to use that as a fundraiser for our crew. So it's going out next week. But the skills challenge scorecards are brilliant. They are just brilliant. So we have one, and I would use some of this stuff with the lads going back. I would use with the Sigerson teams. So they're scoring challenges, tackling challenges, foot passing challenges, free taking challenges. There's, you know, obviously, and this is the bit from, you know, from a coaching perspective, and I say this a lot, you know, when you go we can all set up exercises that, you know, foot passing exercise and scoring exercise or hand passing exercise. But the coaching in those is the key. And I always go back to the biggest lesson I learned was at the end of 2013 with our lads, after obviously been successful in that All-Ireland final. We had done an 18-shot scoring challenge in every single training session. And at the end of the year in the wash-up, it wasn't that it was the scoring challenge was done in every session. And in fairness, there was things the players came back with and that, you know, at the start, we were doing them at the start of the training session when they were fresh, and that they came back to us saying, yeah, but when your legs are hanging off you on the 67 minute of an All-Ireland final, you need to be fatigued. So we changed the scoring challenges to the end of the training session. But the key, and this is coming back to your cultural thing and your language, the key thing they came back to us at the end of that year was, the number one thing was the repetition of the language. And what was the language? Head down, land running, chest dictates direction, full pendulum, so your legs swing. And I have those nuggets in this manual. And I would say that to people, the drills, if you want to call them that, they're an exercise or a medium in which for you to assess the player. That's all they are. So when you're watching them, you're not watching the ball going over the bar saying great score. You're watching them, is the head down? Is that, are they landing running? Is the chest facing where? So that's you coaching. And that's, for me, that's the key aspect, the difference between somebody, which I would have been 20 years ago, a trainer. I was a trainer. Like, I look back now and think, what was I doing in 2003? I was training teams. I'd like to think in 2023, I'm coaching teams.
Okay. Yeah, very good. And those kind of things that you're talking about there, again, from kind of golfing parlance, would be like swing thoughts. So a guy is stepping up to a driver, and he's got these three or four little swing thoughts that are embedded in his head from over and over and over that repetition. And I'll put a link to that resource maybe in the description and stuff. But where, if people are looking for those cards in that pack, where would they be able to find those?
I'll send it on to you again. It's gone up on Shopify, e.commerce site, but I'll send it on to you, Mike. Yeah.
Send me on the link and I'll put it on the podcast description.
The one I'm particularly excited about is the skills challenges for players, because you know yourself, you get a kick out of that. You get a kick out of seeing people been able to measure their own development and see, because I see it now with the younger kids with us, just watching them, you know, taking ownership of their own stuff. And it's not that they have to be like, it's not you're taking the fun out of it.
Yeah.
It's like, I did a session last night with a minor boys team in the club, and, you know, we were going through their score and asking them, what score? We scored 4 out of 6. Very good. The two you missed, what you do? I don't know. Well, how are you going to score the next time if you don't know? And then the next time you ask them, what you do? Well, I think I lifted my head. That's brilliant. So you lifted your head, right? So the head's the heaviest part of your body. So that's a massive weight shift, right? So now, try keeping your head down the next time. Okay, what you score now? 5 out of 6. Brilliant. What, the one you missed, what happened? I definitely lifted my head. That's super. Now you're understanding why you scored and why you didn't score. And they, so that's in a 40-minute session. And like, but the incremental improvements you can start to make, you know, where was your shoulder? Where was your chest? Where did you land? So, you know, an awful lot of kids shoot and they stop rather than putting their weight into the shot. But all those little things, like there's 5 or 6 key pointers for a coach that they can have a massive knock-on effect on the player by constantly repeating. So that bit, that's the bit that for me, that's the bit that gets the buzz, you know.
Yeah.
All of a sudden you're helping them. And you're saying it to them. I mean, I'm looking at myself here 7 years on with some of our players, and I'm still saying the same thing. I mean, and yeah, I often remind myself of the, you know, the book Bounce about table tennis. How long does it take to perfect a skill? 1,000 hours. And I'd often say to myself, Mick, you still haven't put 1,000 hours in with this. So much of knowledge you're getting frustrated, they still haven't had. So do you still have to keep saying it 7 years on? Yeah.
Yeah. And funnily, as you were talking there about, particularly about recording recording your scores. Dave Hoopla, or Hopla, I think maybe is the pronunciation. He's a basketball shooting coach. He was over actually in Tralee. He did a tour around Ireland, but he would have worked with all like the, you know, he's still working with guys over in the NBA, top shooting guys. And his big thing when he was speaking to the kids was like, write it down. If you take 100 shots today and you get 70 shots, write it down. And then tomorrow, when you shoot and you get 72 or you get 68, write it down. Keep track of it every single day. He was like, I know it's a pain and I know it's difficult to do, but you will see an incredible improvement in your shooting if you record your results, because you have a track of your progress and you know where you've been. And it sounds like a very, you know, mundane thing to do or difficult thing to do, but it makes perfect sense. If you want to keep a record, it's obviously a very, very good idea, you know?
Brilliant. And I mean, like, I think back to the time I was involved with the lads. We didn't have these at the time, but I used to record for them. And they text you, you know, what does such and such score? Because yeah, Jim took huge mass and the percentage. So we used to give them the percentages, you know, you were whatever, 72% or you were 85%. And just on that, and I'd often say this to people, this was a serious reflection on Jim as a coach. Philly McMahon, and I can't, I did an interview with him recently, and he told me the year, and I still forget it. Could have been 2012, 13, 14, I can't remember. But he had something like 14 shots between National League and Championship, and he scored twice. And when Jim came in, he said to him, okay, unlike most coaches where, you know, your cornerback, do your job, give the ball to Bernard Brogan, whatever. He said, not until you become a 70% finisher are you allowed to take those shots on again. And I remember I said this to Philly. I said, that was absolutely brilliant coaching. He didn't say to you, you're not allowed to shoot. Mm. He said to you, you want to shoot, you get your percentages up. So we were recording the percentages. And then the All-Ireland final, the Gooch marked him, and I mean that's the one that it's irrelevant, obviously. That's the story where it's easy to say, but my point on it, long before that day, Jim had set the work in stone that it's not a matter of you don't shoot, you do, but you earn it. And that for me is coaching.
But last one, I just want to, because I'm always conscious that we have people that listen to this that are coaching at all different age groups, at all different levels and different games. And one of the biggest kind of, you know, ideas I have out of this is to maximize the number of kids that we have playing our games for longer, GAA or basketball, rugby, it doesn't matter. And from your experience as obviously working in PE and through all the different teams that you've worked with, male and female, which you're offering a very, you know, unique perspective in one sense, like what are a couple of the things that we need to do as coaches to not have the kind of drop off out of our sports that we're seeing that are all too prevalent today?
So obviously there's a higher drop off in girls than there is in boys. There's probably more noise about the drop off in boys, because if the truth be told, and as one of our girls said to me last season, there was a club in Dublin was really struggling in girls football, and she was said to me, if it was the equivalent male team, the club would be doing absolutely everything they could to make sure it survives. But that's not what happens in the female section. Now, as regards our youth, we did something with our group back in 2008, 19, and we went a little bit in depth. We were obviously after having a tough couple of years, 14, 15, 16, had lost three All-Irelands, a lot of them, probably three or four of the key players, struggling whether they would stay on or not. And then obviously 17 was huge, but they still hadn't beaten Cork. And then, sorry, it was 2018, not 2018. And we knew this was going to be a big year, because the way the draw was panning out, we were going to play Cork and there was no avoiding them, which obviously was now that was what they would have wanted, because it would have been forever said they won their All-Ireland, but they didn't beat Cork. Yeah. And we went a little bit in depth into find what was this all about? Why were they playing the game? What was the reason that, you know, girls were coming 4 or 5 times a week, giving up their social lives, all this? And much and all, is there's a huge kudos to be play at the top level. There is a lot you're putting aside for it. You know, it's not as simple as, yeah, I'm going to give another year. This time of year, male and female, a lot of thought goes into it, whether people are going to sign up again for another season. But the number one reason why these kids were playing the game was for their families. The value that their families put on them playing. Now, I'd often have seen this back through the years with the kids in school. If the kids came from a background that valued sport, the kids tended to keep going. But you asked the question, what will keep them involved? Us valuing what they do, not pressurizing them, valuing them, constantly encouraging them, telling them about. I'd often say to my two, and this one I've had to work on, like, I mean, when they weren't particularly good or they weren't as good as they should be, that's fine. You didn't do this. But if you know, but the bottom line is, these are things you did do well, or it wasn't a particularly good day for you and you knew going out you weren't in good form, whatever else, but you turned up and you showed your team that it mattered to them. So that valuing. But the other thing that's particularly, Ken, there is a big difference between boys and girls in this, and lots of studies have been done on it. Girls play for the social aspect. And when we say social in Ireland, a lot of people tend to say, think of pubs and clubs and whatever else. That's not what social is. COVID taught us what social was. Being able to sit down for a meal at the end of training or go for a coffee with a mate or whatever else. Girls play much more for the social aspect than the boys do. Boys play much more to try and be successful. But I spoke to a nephew of mine this evening who he plays rugby and he wasn't getting in the first team in Clontarf. And I was asking him, would you not go down and play a bit of Gaelic football at the moment? And he said, I'm not particularly good at Gaelic football. And I said, yeah, but there's loads of teams. There's a social team. Like, I had a young fellow who was very good at underage, but he had a lot of bad injuries with his knees and he had 3 surgeries. And I remember coming back to his, you know, 32 months out at this stage. And this was the statement he said to me. I was asking him about his aspirations when he was going back. And he said, you know what I missed the most? And I said, what's that? Been a part of something. And that is so important for our youth. Been made to feel a part of something. Like, I mean, is it about winning or losing? At a certain level, for sure it is. I mean, when you go to the top level, it's like I was talking to a pal of mine today, and we were just saying, like, I mean, it's so unfair to so many people do so much good work, but if they don't end up with the trophy, they don't, you know, get the kudos. But ultimately, you think of the thousands of people who can play the game. They don't have to be playing it on the first team in the club or the second team. I mean, the whole aspect, and that's one of the things I actually do love about Gaelic games is, you know, you don't have the tendency, if you're not getting your game with the A team, that you're going to go to another club. You're happy enough to play with the B team or the C team or whatever. So that thing of been made feel good about yourself, been made to feel a part of something, right? And, you know, us as parents and whatever, I can't wait to watch you play. I mean, it could be the worst football in the world, but to be told, imagine your dad turning around, putting your hand on your shoulder, I can't wait to watch you play. And you feel like you've won the lottery. So we do have a big... We do have a big knock-on effect on them in that regard.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose as coaches as well, we don't have huge control over, you know, what's said in the car coming to training or going home from training. All you can do, I suppose, if you're a coach, is make sure you value them when they're there in front of you and make sure they keep coming back. And as a parent, I that's becoming more common now as a parent that people are, it's something that I was poor at, and I'm still not great at it, is not trying to give them a critical review after every training session or every game, because as I'm doing it, I understand that I shouldn't be doing it. But it's an area of improvement that now you can say, you know what? Really, really loved watching you play. Thought your effort was brilliant today. Well done. And if there is something else, then yeah, sure. Maybe we could have a chat about it later, but not in that car Brilliant. Drive home or that walk home. It's
Mike, I tell this story, and this is obviously true. Kevin, who's 22, I had Kevin's team from 4 to 16, and I deliberately stepped back at 16 for their minor because I just wanted a new voice, right?
Yeah.
But I would still say this, when I do my coaching course, because we all had to learn somewhere. You didn't come with all of the guns and roses. And I still remember an under 10 or an under 11 match over in Ballyboden. Kevin was with Clontarf, and it was a hurling game, wasn't even a football game. And my gra was with the football, obviously. And at the end of the game, I was collecting the cones, and he was up at the car, and he was a tall young fella, and he was leaning on the roof. And one of the parents says to him afterwards, "Jeez, Kevin, it wouldn't be that down. You only lost by a point." And he says, "Yeah, but you don't have to go back across to Liffey, my old fella." And I remember when I was told that back in the club, I remember thinking, seriously, did he say that? And I remember, Jesus, is that the effect I'm having?
Yeah.
And I went home. I went for a pint in the club, and I went home and I said to Kev, "You and me, into the room now." And I sat with him and I said, "Here's the deal. From now on, I am not going to critique you. If you want my advice, you ask me. If you want me to give you, but boy, just bear with me on this one. When you ask me, I'm going to spare nothing. I'm going to tell you as I see it. But if you don't want it, I won't say it."
Yeah, that's.
So that's the deal we made that day.
That's good. I like it. I might write that down on paper myself and sign it for the two boys. No, it is. Yeah. And you know what? That would be a great message for all parents themselves to just take on board. And everybody, and the killer is, everybody's meeting well. We're doing it because I want you to, you know, maximize your potential and to be as good as you can be. But really what we're doing is actually telling them that maybe you'd be better off just playing chess or playing the PlayStation, because you don't have to deal with me critiquing you every day. So it's anyway, that's another rabbit hole. Mick, I really appreciate your time, and I'm conscious now that it's very late, and that was brilliant. I really enjoyed that chat. Is there anything that we haven't touched in that very comprehensive discussion that you'd like to touch on before we finish, or are we good to wrap?
I'll say this to you, just to finish, Mike, right? In my career, I've been, and I was up in the park last night doing, Friday night, and by pure coincidence, Jim Gavin came across, and he was doing a session with his young fellas team, the under-16s, and it so happens, neither of us are in our own club, we're in our new club, right, where our kids are, and we had this conversation last night about just the whole inter-county scene, and, you know, like, as he said himself, he's had no regrets over, you know, so many things in life, and particularly his time with Dublin, except the time he lost out with his own children. And I often, you know, I I've had this conversation over the last number of years, you know, getting involved with lads' teams, and I've often said, I have two young girls, and my two older ones, Kevin and Kate, their formative years, and they're, you know, they've moved on. But I couldn't get involved with a fellas team at the moment. I just couldn't, because I would not sacrifice what those two have, you know, their few. And what's different, and I was saying this to Jim last night, if we're under pressure here, or even sometimes if they want to come over and, you know, kick a ball and whatever else, I can bring them in the car to the training session. Not saying that the standards are any different, but the cultural aspect is more family orientated. And I have that with my management team. Not that we're a creche, and the training session, when it's on, it's on. It's full alert, and there's no kids in the changing room or on the pitch and whatever else. But it does allow for that aspect of coaching, you know, or that aspect of a family involvement. And for me, that Goldust, I couldn't go through it again. I already went through that period with the older two, definitely lost out on my time, you know, at a really important stage in their lives. And I look now and say, you know, lessons learned. And I think of that, like, you know, you get the opportunity to be involved with your kids' teams, and it's such a special time in their lives, because they do look up to you. Coming back to, you know, even at times when they disagree with us and they're giving out about what we say and whatever else, the number one reason our crew were playing inter-county football was not for us, was not for the county, it was for the families, right? So if they're saying that, well, what are the rest of the kids saying? So we have such a bearing on it. Anyway, there you go.
Mick, again, thanks a million for your time. I would have mentioned at the start, I'm kind of doing this, Mick, as I mentioned, for the Lily Daly Foundation as well, which is a new charity that's after been set up in Tralee, in Kerry, specifically for Crumlin Children's Hospital and the Heart Ward up there and the Ronald McDonald House. So for people that do find value in the content of that discussion,
I know.
I thought it was really enjoyable. It would be fantastic if people could you know, throw a couple of euros into that. And if not, if you can't afford to throw in a few euros, just share it around the place, put it into your coaching WhatsApp groups and your clubs and get it to plenty of ears, because the more people that listen, the more people will contribute. So Mick, again, thanks a million for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
Cheers, Mike. Much appreciated. Nice talk to you.